It's 11 o'clock. You're tuned to WFVR-LP, South Royalton, Vermont, Free Vermont Radio. Green Zine is up next, and you know what? It's maple syrup time.
First, you get the buckets ready, clean the pans, and gather firewood late in the winter. It's maple syrup time. You need warm and sunny days, but still a cold and freezing nighttime for just a few weeks. Maple syrup time. We boil and boil and boil and boil it all day long, till 97% of water evaporates just like this song. And when what is left is syrupy, don't leave it too long. Keep up the fire, maple syrup time.
Make the maracas.
System, but each year I can't resist it. Get out the buckets and tap the trees in time. Making it is half the fun, satisfaction when it's done. Keep up the fire, maple syrup time. My grandpa says perhaps it's just a waste of time. Ah, but no more than this attempt to make a happy little rhyme. So swing your tail or pat your feet, but keep in good time. Keep up the fire, maple syrup time.
Make the maracas now.
Girl, hoping they don't mind a little advice in rhyme. As in life or revolution, rarely is there a quick solution. Everything worthwhile takes a little time. We boil and boil and boil and boil it all life long, till what is left is syrupy. Don't leave it on the flame too long, but seize the minute, build a new world. Sing an old song. Keep up the fire, maple syrup time. Keep up the fire, maple syrup time. Keep up the fire, maple syrup time.
Split wood, not atoms.
Keep up the fire, maple syrup time.
Oh, I forgot about that line towards the end of that Pete Seeger classic. We played Moxie Fruvis's version of that last week. That Canadian group, yeah, we're still friends with them. Hopefully they think we're friends. Maple Syrup Time, and along with some friends, one of the many compilations, three that I can think of out on the Appleseed label, down with Jim Musselman in Westchester, Pennsylvania, Pete Seeger and Friends in Maple Syrup Time. Yeah, Split Wood, not Adams. More of that, you know, winter's right around the corner. Oh, wait, we're exiting winter, but some of us are already thinking about next winter and might be out splitting some wood. Hey, this is Green Zine here at Royalton Community Radio. As Henry mentioned a couple weeks ago, he is traveling. He's out in the Pacific Northwest visiting family. I hope he's having a great time. He'll be back with us next week. I have put together a number of items, a couple of recorded items. I'm actually watching one spin and spin, so we might not hear that one on the air, but we do have a piece from a nature writer for the New York Times. Her name is Margaret Renkel. She lives down in Nashville, Tennessee. We also are going to play an episode from a podcast put together, actually not a podcast, but a slightly less than a half an hour from Extinction Rebellion, which is an international group that is fighting climate change and very, very active around the world. Well, let's acknowledge our underwriters here, and then we're going to talk a little bit more about maple syrup. Yeah. Greens In is brought to you today by the Yes We Can Collective, and people are asking me about that. We're going to be discussing it at our board meeting. We're probably going to try an in-house experiment with a collective, and if that works, then it may end up being a more local, not global. We're not going global. It might be opened up to people that live nearby the radio station. White River Land Collaborative also helping us out. Wit and Grit, a breakfast and lunch restaurant in Randolph, Vermont. Solaflek, yeah, they're the solar tracking company down in Norwich, Vermont. Bale, building a local economy. You can check out all the activities that they're up to at balevt.org. Tom Wells and Royal Trailworks, he attended our underwriter member staff party last weekend. It was good to see him there. Daniel Leibowitz down in the swamp, our very first treasurer of this radio station more than 12 years ago. The Upper Pass Beer Company, First Branch Coffee Company, and Solarfest. I can tell you a little bit more about Solarfest. I helped them out a little bit. That festival will be held in Brandon, Vermont on the 8th, 9th, and 10th of August. So you have a lot of planning to do for that. We hope that you will come if you're interested in all aspects of sustainability, battling climate change, EVs, agroforestry, organic agriculture, farming, etc. Solarfest is the place to be. They're planning to put on about 40 to 50 environmental workshops during the course of the weekend. Saturday is a key music day. I can give you a little heads up. A couple of bands that have been confirmed. Donna the Buffalo will be playing and wrapping things up on Saturday night, and they'll be preceded by a great jamgrass band out of North Carolina that is called Into the Fog. Well, if you had enough maple syrup in your coffee this morning, you're probably not in the fog anymore. And yeah, it is maple syrup time in Vermont. There's a lot of boiling and sap. I've seen the old tin buckets around. I've seen the blue bags. Careful with those blue bags. They are made out of plastic, but they're pretty handy for collecting sap. And on page the opening section of Section B of today's Herald, in the sugar house with friends and families. And there's a picture of a guy that I know, Jim Hewitt. Neighbors, friends, and family share stories, taste hot syrup, and sign the door during a boil last Saturday, St. Patty's Day, at, well, it wouldn't be, Saturday afternoon would not have been March 17th, so I'm going to say that it was March 15th, at Jim and Jenny Hewitt's J. Crew Sugar Shack on the Davis Road in Royalton. For basketball fans, March Madness plays on a TV in the corner of the Sugar House. A family operation, J. Crew Sugar Shack, is named for members of the Hewitt clan. Yep, we got four J's here: Jim, Jenny, Jake, and Jocelyn. Coming up this weekend, starting on the weekend, Friday, Saturday and Sunday, March 22nd and 23rd, yeah, the sugar houses are opening up, large and small. They invite visitors in to sample hot syrup, take a tour of their operation, and indulge in treats like creamies and sap-boiled hot dogs. How about sap-boiled tofu pups? No critters were injured with the tofu pups as part of the Maple Open House Weekend. For more information, because there's a lot of local sugar houses that are opening up, Silloway Maple is featured. Of course, they're a really big deal, but go visit some of the smaller ones. There is a map of the participating sugar houses. This is easy to remember. The website, vermontmaple.org. Yeah, vermontmaple.org. As I said, I've got a couple of tape things, and I'm making sure, yeah, we are going to go to Birds and Bears. And, you know, bird feeders, time to take down the bird feeders. The bears are out. But right now, we're going to go to this piece from Bird Note. It's called Spring Bursts Forth. You're tuned to Green Zine here at Royalton Community. Let's make sure that's not running anymore. Good, we did that. Yeah, there's a lot going on here. We like to keep things going on at the radio station. No dead air allowed today.
This is Bird Note. We often hear it said that spring bursts forth as if winter's leafless trees suddenly shimmer with green. Flowers pop. Birds start singing with all their hearts. But this seasonal change isn't instantaneous. It's a series of waves, slowly breaking waves that sweep up from the south to the north, right over the continent. Early spring migrants like robins and bluebirds return north in March, some even in February. Across the whole of April, week after week, new songbird migrants work north from the tropics, adding bit by bit to spring's ever-growing soundtrack. By May, birds continue flooding into northerly states in Canada. And even as late as June, birds like willow flycatchers and morning warblers are just completing the trek to northern breeding sites from South America. By this time, those early robins may already be hard at work feeding their second brood. For them, spring has been bursting for over 3 months. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann.
Well, as I said, it's time to take down those bird feeders. Yeah, the birds are welcome back, but the bears are not welcome in your front yard or your backyard. So take them down so they can stay in the woods and forage around. Here's a song about bears from the Quicksilver Messenger Service right here on Green Zine, sending you a message. That's a little scary. Hopefully you won't have an encounter with your bird feeder and the bear. You're tuned to Green Zine. We're about 14 minutes into the program. Hey, real quick, I saw a headline on today's Valley News and heard about it the other day. We know there are a lot of cuts being made by the central government. Yeah, down in Washington. And one of them is to the ag sector cutting back on food that you're normally extra food that would go to schools and stuff. So check out the front page of the Valley News for more information on that. A little bit later in the show, we'll hopefully get a piece on about the rebates and incentives being taken away from EVs. But right now, we're going to go to an extended piece, just under a half hour long, from a group that Henry and I are very familiar with. In fact, there was a meeting at Bail with some local members of Extinction Rebellion. It is a global pro-climate group. Yeah, sustainability, climate, let's use cleaner energy sources. And they're called Extinction Rebellion. And here is their latest episode that they've put up on one of the services that we use here, which is from the Pacifica Radio Network called Audioport. So sit back and listen. There's a lot of talk about this country and Canada with recent changes in environmental protections. Here's a piece from Extinction Rebellion right here on Green Zine.
This is Extinction Rebellion Radio on Pacifica Radio Network. Extinction Rebellion Radio is hosted by Matthew Kearney and Ailee Slane.
Welcome to the Rebellion.
This is Extinction Rebellion Radio on Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Matthew Kearney. In the past week, we've seen climate repeals, climate regulation, climate policy repeals in both the United States and Canada. First, the United States. That's the big one. Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Lee Zeldin says he's going to reconsider the endangerment finding. Okay, what's the endangerment finding? The endangerment finding goes back to the Obama administration. It said that climate change endangered human life and human health. That's a simple deduction from basic science. It's like the most simple thing that one could say about the climate crisis, that it endangers human life and human health. Nobody with any understanding of climate crisis at all would doubt that this endangers human life and human health. It's rather a scandal in American history that it took all the way until the Obama administration to say that as a matter of like U.S. government policy. It was from the Environmental Protection Agency under Obama. So the Obama administration, the Biden administration, and yes, even the first Trump administration had this endangerment finding. It meant they acknowledged that human survival was in danger. So they acknowledged that. They just didn't do much about it. If we talk to an Obama staffer or a Biden administration staffer or Obama or Biden themselves, they'll point to legislation. They'll say this was climate legislation that we did, but in a brass tacks bottom line sense, nothing was accomplished on climate because emissions keep going up. And if you're interested in dealing with climate change, the whole ball game is greenhouse gas emissions. And greenhouse gas emissions kept going up under Obama, they kept going up under Trump, they kept going up under Biden, and now they're going up under new Trump. You know, you could say at least they acknowledged the problem, and that's what the endangerment finding was. Once you had that endangerment finding in place, the policy conversation was around what to do to tackle this problem, because the problem was formally acknowledged. Activists could say you aren't living up to your own statements of what is necessary. Now, the second Trump administration is going to unacknowledge the problem, unless the word is de-acknowledge the problem. Make that endangerment finding go away. Claim that it might not be true that greenhouse gas emissions are a threat to public health and human welfare. Greenhouse gas emissions might not be a threat to human survival after all. That's what they're claiming. Reversing. Now, over a decade of formal acknowledgement that the climate crisis threatens humans. It's making climate denialism a policy. Trump administration is going to make climate denialism a policy, not just a statement on Truth Social media feed, not just a statement on X, formerly Twitter, not just a statement at a press conference, but actual policy. This changes the conversation. In a way, this conversation is all ephemeral anyway. Emissions were going up with the endangerment finding. They will continue going up without the endangerment finding. Will they go up further and faster than they otherwise would have? That's hard to know. Maybe. But nobody has a solid method for determining that. Still, it changes the conversation. The repeal of the endangerment finding changes the conversation, and it leads to absurdities. Removing the fossil fuel finding is to say that fossil fuels don't endanger human health or survival. That's like saying that this bullet headed for your head is not a danger to you. That's like saying that this knife that's currently slitting into your chest and heading for your heart is not a danger to you. That's like saying that bomb that just dropped from the plane and is going straight for your house is not a danger to you. It's an obvious contradiction to reality. An obvious contradiction to reality. Not just a false statement, but a fatally, deathly false statement. Our president has made a living, literally, out of contradicting reality. He has made many statements on the campaign trail, in office, in his business, that contradict reality. Even his supporters admit that. This is part of what they mean when they say, take him seriously, not literally. But now, what's different with this is he's making United States policy a contradiction of reality. To reconsider the endangerment finding, the Trump Environmental Protection Agency will have to ignore all scientific evidence, even the most rudimentary of scientific findings, even the most widely consented to and most basic facts of modern science will have to be ignored and set aside to reconsider the endangerment finding. The only case they have to make is about short-term money. If they repeal the endangerment finding, they can repeal certain environmental regulations. If they repeal certain environmental regulations, certain companies will be able to make more money. That's what it's all about. And that's really all there is to it. I think that's the only thing it's about. I see no other justification that can be made, and I see no other justification that they're interested in making. If you repeal the endangerment finding, the effect will be that certain companies will be able to make more money. If you make denial of reality and ignorance of fundamental science the new policy of the United States, the effect will be that certain companies will be able to make more money because it will allow you to remove certain regulations. That more money will reach these companies and it will stop at those companies. It will not trickle down. It will not benefit the general population. It will not lift all boats. It will not affect you and me financially. Probably no one listening to this program even will get a little bit richer from this. Probably not anyone listening to this program will get even a little bit richer from the repeal of these regulations. It's solely certain companies that have a role in fossil fuel industry. If the fossil fuel companies have assigned some junior analyst to scour the media landscape for criticism and is listening to this and keeping tabs on us, and they probably have done that, then junior staffer spying for the fossil fuel companies listening to this, you too will not benefit from this. You're probably too junior in your company. It's probably going to be the shareholders. It's not, unless you have stock options in your company, you're not going to benefit from this either. Even the rank and file employees from the fossil fuel companies are not going to benefit from this. It's going to be the big shareholders. It's going to be the large shareholders. It's going to be the C-suite executives and probably them only. Those are the folks who can hire the lobbyists to get this stuff done. Those are the folks who can give the large-scale campaign contributions such that a staffer in the White House will pick up their phone call. Those are the folks who will keep on underpaying their own junior staffers relative to the value that is generated for them. So, junior staffer, if you're listening to this and you've been assigned by your fossil fuel company overlords to keep tabs on us, you too will not benefit from this. So I stand by my statement that probably no one listening to this program will get even a little bit richer from this, because probably no one listening to this program is a major shareholder of a fossil fuel company. To review, the Environmental Protection Agency administrator says they're going to reconsider the endangerment finding. They're going to claim that climate change is not a threat to human health. Might as well be saying there's no gravity. Might as well be saying gravity does not make things fall to the ground. There's loads of other climate change policies going on. Here's one of them. The new Trump administration has cut $20 billion of climate and environmental grants. These were passed under the Biden administration. They were frozen before, part of the large-scale freezing of federal spending that the new Trump administration did. Well, this is they took the extra step. Instead of just freezing the funding, they took the extra step of canceling the grants. $20 billion, this was just last week. I'm recording this on March 18th of 2025. So, you know, that's a significant amount of money, $20 billion that would have been spent on climate and environmental things. I don't have the itemization of what they all were for, but it's, you know, it actually kind of flew below the radar a little bit amidst all the consternation and bigger headline gathering that was happening, especially around the Ukraine war negotiations. In addition to that $20 billion, there's a $1.7 billion group of diversity, equity, and inclusion environmental justice grants, 400 of them, totaling about $1.7 billion. All those were canceled too. I don't know what was in all of those grants. You know, I don't have the itemization of them. Obviously, you know, when you're evaluating this decision, you're curious to know what was in these things. But what probably happened was they just took everything that had the words diversity, equity, or inclusion in them and cut that, probably without looking into it. So just what these things were, I don't know, but I'm guessing that the Trump administration that cut them doesn't know what they were either. Another policy development, a federal judge stopped the funding freeze. The Trump administration has frozen a huge amount of U.S. federal government spending. A federal judge named John J. McConnell Jr. said they can't do that. And one of the reasons he cited was climate readiness. Disaster response. He said that there would be an inability to respond to a natural disaster if this funding freeze was put in place. And he found a way to claim that that's unconstitutional, that these funds have to be available for natural disaster. He cited something called the Impoundment Control Act of 1974, saying that the president cannot unilaterally freeze funds according to that act. And, you know, he specifically mentioned readiness for a natural disaster. He specifically mentioned floods and fires. Here's the quote from Judge McConnell's decision. Quote, in an event and acute harm with floods and fires wreaking havoc across the country, federal funding for emergency management and preparedness would be impacted, unquote. He didn't use the word climate. He might as well have. Floods and fires wreaking havoc across the country. He's talking about climate change. He's talking about climate disasters. It's because of climate disasters that a federal judge blocked the new president's freeze of federal spending. This is Extinction Rebellion Radio on Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Matthew Kearney, and we're talking about climate policy reversals of the past week or so here in mid-March of 2025, both in the United States and in Canada. Reversals of long-established climate policies.
You are listening to Green Zine at Royalton Community Radio, Free Vermont Radio.
Now, up in Canada, there's a new prime minister. Mark Carney is his name. This guy's supposed to be the good guy. There's a certain automatic sympathy for a country that's getting picked on the way Canada's getting picked on. I mean, we've got a neighboring country with a bigger military very much bullying Canada. I'm talking about the United States. Very much bullying Canada. The president is openly discussing conquering the country, subjugating it militarily. You wouldn't, even in a bad dream, you wouldn't expect that to happen. And everybody's wondering if he's joking or not, but everybody's been wondering that for a few weeks now, and he keeps not saying that he's joking. So, you know, Canadians, including outgoing Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, have said, look, we have to take this seriously. We have to take this as an actual military threat that the United States is making against us. Okay, when you hear that sort of thing, you feel an automatic certain sympathy for Canada. At least I do. I'm American as a citizen, but I did live in Canada for a time, a year and a half. I had a job up there. Also, there's a certain sympathy for Canada. They're clearly the victims in this trade war that's going on. The supply of fentanyl is supposedly the reason for the trade war. That's what President Trump keeps saying. In fact, almost no fentanyl comes across the border from Canada. It comes almost entirely from Mexico. That's the importation point. The reason it comes from Mexico into the United States is because there's a demand for it by American citizens. People want to buy it in the United States and use it as an illegal drug. Blaming Canada for this and arguably blaming Mexico for it is a little bit of a stretch. But certainly there's no, you know, whatever level of blame we assign to Mexico for this situation or certain actors within Mexico for this situation, there's simply no blame to Canada. America's fentanyl problem is not caused by Canada. There's no justification, really, morally, for the trade war that Trump has put into place. If he wants to renegotiate trade agreements, that's one thing, but it just guns blazing trade war is hard to understand, either from an economic perspective or from a moral perspective or from a geopolitical perspective. Just what does he think he's accomplishing? I've said previously on this program, I expect these tariffs to be either small or short. Too early to tell whether my prediction is going to bear out correctly or not. Anyway, all this creates a certain automatic sympathy for Canada. And so this guy, Mark Carney, takes office with a lot of goodwill globally. Let's hope he doesn't squander it for the sake of Canada and for world politics. And really, it in no way would help the United States for him to squander the goodwill that he has. You want a healthy, politically healthy country on your border. But Mark Carney is not like a hero. I mean, he's a very much a ruling class figure. He was the head of the Bank of England. He was the head of the Bank of Canada. He was an investment banker who made a huge personal fortune. I mean, this guy is deeply enmeshed in ruling class wealth and prestige and privilege and now politics. He's never been elected to anything. I mean, he still hasn't been elected to anything. He was selected by an internal process within the Canadian Liberal Party. And now he's been sworn in as prime minister. One of the first things he did was to eliminate carbon pricing in Canada. This was a Trudeau policy. Early in his prime ministerial tenure, Trudeau put this into place, a price on carbon. It was one of the holy grails of climate activism for a while. Some of the, shall we say, center-leaning climate activists were saying a price on carbon is the way to go. You still see books coming out these days saying prices on carbon are the way to go. Essentially, it's just a tax on carbon emissions meant to make carbon emissions more expensive. The only way that that can work well to actually reduce emissions is if it's paired with a transition from fossil fuel sources to green energy sources, to zero emission or very low emission sources. If you don't do that, if you just tax carbon and then keep on using carbon, all you're doing is making everything more expensive, everything that carbon touches, which is virtually everything in the economy. So it's inflationary. It raises the price of goods. It raises the price of energy. It raises the price of fuel. It raises the price of food. It raises the price of all the sorts of things that are powered by fossil fuels. Even indirectly, which is going to be nearly everything in the entire economy. Raising the price of carbon alone does very little unless we can massively reduce our energy consumption, which is not happening, or unless we can massively convert from fossil fuel use to green energy use, such as wind and solar, such as electric car batteries. If those batteries are made in a low emission way, such as geothermal energy, depending on exactly how it's configured, maybe even such as nuclear. That's a whole nother question of whether nuclear is a good idea or not. But it is, in fact, at point of use or at point of generation, it's a zero emission source. So it's in the conversation, right? The point is that carbon pricing without conversion to zero emission sources of energy only increases inflation. It doesn't reduce carbon emissions. It doesn't tackle climate change at all. So what you really need to do is convert energy use. The carbon price is secondary. The carbon price is not the main task. The main task is to bring green energy sources online at huge scales such that you can replace large portions of our fossil fuel burning with green energy use. You can do that with a carbon price. You can do that without a carbon price. But the carbon price alone, Canada's experience proves that the carbon price alone doesn't cause that to happen. Because Canada has not mass converted to green energy. Sure, the amount of green energy it's using has gone up, but so has the amount of fossil fuels it's using. Canada's just using more, like the United States, Canada's using more energy from fossil fuels and using more energy from zero emission sources. proving that carbon pricing doesn't get the job done. They've had carbon pricing in Canada. You could say, well, they haven't made the price high enough. But this has become deeply politically unpopular because it's raising the price of goods. It's raising the price of energy. It's raising the price of food. It's raising the price of all sorts of manufacturing. It's raising the prices of everything. And it's not delivering climate benefits. And the Canadians are aware of this. They might have borne the cost if they could see clearly the climate benefits, but there are no clear climate benefits from this carbon pricing program in Canada. It's a fairly bold statement I just made. There are no clear climate benefits. There's going to be some environmental advocates who are going to criticize it, but come on, guys. Emissions are going up. As long as emissions are going up, we are not getting the job done. As long as emissions are going up, what we are doing isn't working. They've had this carbon price in place for years and emissions are going up. Clearly, it's not working. Obviously, it's not working. They still have an industrial carbon tax on large emitters. That's also going to be inflationary, by the way. But the kind of direct carbon pricing that they've had, Carney cut it. He cut it almost immediately after taking off, like days after he, like maybe even hours, I don't know. But very quickly after he took office, he cut that program. This is Extinction Rebellion Radio on Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Matthew Kearney, and we're talking about climate policy reversals of the past week or so here in mid-March of 2025, both in the United States and in Canada. Reversals of long-established climate policies. You know, there's a strong case to be made that Canada did not put this into place very sensibly. They have carbon pricing. And then they have a rebate to Canadian citizens to offset the cost of the carbon pricing. So what money is being raised from this? They put a price on carbon, they make goods and services more expensive, and then they refund money to ordinary citizens. They send them checks in the mail. Well, how are people what's the benefit? What's the financial benefit to me if I have to pay more? I get the check in the mail, so that feels like a benefit, but I'm paying more for everything else. So the money's just being shifted around. It's not being spent on the green energy transition. It's not being spent on anything except sent back to the people who were paying it in the first place. So what is this accomplishing macroeconomically? What is this accomplishing for ordinary consumer finances? It wasn't a deeply well-designed program. The reason it wasn't a deeply well-designed program was because it did not have the most vital component for dealing with climate crisis, which is a drastic reduction in actual carbon use, replaced by zero or near zero emission sources of fuel and energy. That's the whole ballgame for dealing with climate crisis on a global scale. That's the whole ballgame. Everything else won't work unless that happens. That's the fundamental task of global climate policy. Nothing else will get very far unless that happens. So Carney's gotten rid of this program that may not have been a very effective program in the first place. Maybe that's why he got rid of it. All right. The question arises for new Prime Minister Carney. What are you going to do instead? Sure, you can make a case, as I've sort of just done, that this wasn't a good idea anyway, that this wasn't working anyway, so let's scrap it. Very well. But it raises the obvious question, what will you do on climate change? If you're not going to do this carbon pricing program that may not have been working anyway, what will you do? What will be your climate policy? You must have a bold, aggressive climate policy. You must campaign on it. You must implement it because this guy's going to have an election campaign in Canada to run soon. He's going to be, he's up against conservatives who are not very climate friendly, who are very fossil fuel friendly. So again, Carney's going to look like the good guy. He must actually become the good guy by having a bold and aggressive policy for drastically reducing fossil fuel emissions. There are more climate policy reversals yet to come. For example, I think the UK is getting ready to abandon its 2050 commitment to net zero. Back when Theresa May was Prime Minister, the United Kingdom promised to get the entire country to net zero by 2050. And they didn't just say so. They didn't just call it a target. Parliament made it a law. It's legally binding. They have to do this. Now, just in mid-March, the Conservative Party, the same party that made this law, is saying, let's ditch it. Kimi Badenoch is the Conservative Party leader. She's saying it's impossible. Net zero is impossible, she says. Well, of course it's possible. We can cut emissions. It's no mystery how to do so. But she denies that, says the UK can't get to net zero, quote, without a serious drop in our living standards or by bankrupting us, unquote. It's not true. There's no need to drop living standards. We know how to get energy in massive quantities from zero emission sources. We can get that energy in quantities so massive that they're comparable to what we've consumed in recent years. We don't have to go back to the Stone Age or the pre-digital age to get this done. The technology is not inordinately expensive. What's inordinately expensive is not using it and dealing with climate catastrophe that's getting ever worse all the time to the point of mass extinction. That's a lot more expensive than net zero. She's trying to scare people into repealing that law so they can cut a bunch of environmental regulations and transfer more money to fossil fuel interests. That's her agenda. The fear is that enough people will start to believe it, that there'll be a lot of saying, there'll be a lot of statements that net zero is incredibly expensive, net zero is incredibly expensive, net zero is incredibly expensive. You hear that over and over again on repeat. You hear it from different sources. Even if people don't have models or know exactly what they mean or know exactly why they're saying it, they'll say it and they'll hear it from others, including people who seem to be authority figures, and it'll start to seem real. It'll start to seem like inevitably true, even if the support for that position is very thin. It need not be phenomenally expensive to use renewable sources of energy. It need not be. Solar panel pricing is low in the world right now. You can buy a lot of solar panels for not very much money. So why don't they do that? It's simpler, it's more convenient to stick with fossil fuels. Even though fossil fuels are limited overall in the global supply, well, if you just keep on burning them until they run out, at least it's easier until that point is reached. It seems like that's where our globe is heading. Kimi Badenoch, leader of the opposition in the UK, is full speed ahead with the fossil fuel agenda. There's no other way, I think, to interpret what she says and what she does. By the way, net zero, which is what we've been talking about, is a pretty paltry target from a scientific point of view. Net zero is not going to rescue us from catastrophe. But if we don't get to net zero, we'll get worse than catastrophe. So they should not repeal this law, not in the UK and not in any other country.
This has been Extinction Rebellion Radio.
Happy to bring you that episode of Extinction Rebellion right here on Green Zine. Yeah, elections do have consequences, not just in the United States. About 17 minutes left in the show, and they're painting a rather dark picture there of leadership or potential leadership in the case of the UK. But also here in this country and in Canada. Well, let's brighten things up a little bit with a little solar information here and very local. Here's a headline written by Isabel Dreyer in the current issue of the White River Valley Herald. Randolph Community Solar 2 project readies for launch. And she goes, this is about another... I don't know if she actually has the wattage on this, but the project dubbed Randolph Community Solar 2 is in partnership with the local installer Catamount Solar They have completed construction on several other community solar projects, including one on the South Randolph Road. I go past that one all the time. I'm pretty sure that is 150 kilowatt, so I would imagine this one might also be 150 kilowatt. The project officially launched late last week, and shares are now available to purchase. According to Jerry Ward, the volunteer who organized the project, interest has been strong so far. Shares are available to anyone who pays their electric bill to Green Mountain Power, including those who rent property rather than owning a house. The project will be constructed on leased private land belonging to Matthew Morosky on the Beanville Road. So a question I guess I would have to either Catamount or to Jerry Ward is, was this project put before the PUC before group net metering was kind of zeroed out? This does sound like a group net metering project, which is very good, as this article goes on to state that you do not have to have solar on your house. Maybe your house is not in an appropriate location to have rooftop or pole-mounted solar, but you can buy a share and be getting your electricity from this community solar plant. I also wonder whether the Vermont Law and Graduate School may have been involved in that project. So there's some good news there. Something else I wanted to point out, if you do pick up the 7 Days, which just came out with a fresh issue yesterday, there is an interesting video and story which I was trying to bring up, but since it's a video, maybe it would be better for you to be watching on a screen rather than listening without the video. You can find information for this on page 9 of 7 Days. Has a nice picture of this woman, naturalist Sophie Mazowita, who specializes in wildlife tracking and spends a lot of time in nature observing the signs that creatures leave behind. 7 Days, Eva Solberger met up with Mazowita on a snowy hillside in Bakersfield to see what wild animals have been making tracks. I did get far enough that I think this is about a 20-minute long video. And the easiest way to find it is just to, in your favorite browser, whatever that is, put in 7 Days and then Stuck in Vermont. And this will come up and you'll be able to view that. Well, I did promise for the last couple of weeks, this piece from Margaret Renkel. She is a journalist for The New York Times, and she submits, well, probably once a month, maybe a little bit longer. She's located in Nashville, and she reports on flora, fauna, politics, and culture in the American South. But this piece goes a little bit beyond that, and I found it pretty interesting. Of course, we had the recent lunar eclipse with the blood moon. Hopefully you got up at 2:30 in the morning to witness that about a week ago. And here's a piece that being read by someone else about the lunar moon and some other natural phenomenon right here on Green Scene. And we have a couple of more items to get to before the end of the show, with Democracy Now! Coming up at noon on Thursday.
There wasn't much chance that I would be awake to see the total eclipse of the bloodworm moon, which was visible late last Thursday night or early Friday morning, depending on the time zone. In Nashville, the eclipse reached totality at 1:25 a.m., an hour I have not willingly seen since the last time there was a newborn baby in this house. Besides, storms were on the way. When I stepped outside after supper to see whether setting my alarm made any sense, all I could see of the worm moon was a tiny lighted patch of sky flashing through a gap between hurrying clouds. A blood moon lunar eclipse happens when Earth lines up between the sun and the moon, casting a shadow that tints the moon red. During years when March is not offering a total lunar eclipse, the full moon is known as the worm moon. The nicknames for moons, the wolf moon in January, the snow moon in February, etc., are derived from Native American tradition. The names varied from tribe to tribe, and European settlers added their own variations, but generally these names represent a natural phenomenon that once tended to occur during that month. According to the Old Farmer's Almanac, which has compiled the full moon's names and the reasons for them, the worm moon is traditionally a time when earthworms reappear as the soil begins to thaw, or, in another telling, when beetle larvae begin to emerge from tree bark. Many Americans, probably most Americans, are now so divorced from their ecosystems that they have no idea what happens to earthworms during the cold months, and even less idea how beetle larvae behave. Continuing to call Macha's full moon the Worm Moon is like calling a shopping center 100 Oaks, because it was built in a place that was heavily wooded before someone decided to build a mall there. Very little on Earth still resembles the planet as it was when the first peoples were naming the full moons. Maybe that's why I'm in love with these names. I love the way they persist despite our culture's aversion, if not outright hostility, to the inconvenient natural world. I am always looking for signs of what can yet be preserved. I am especially looking for the people who are working to preserve them. Last week, when I drove past Elmington Park, I noticed that the Nashville mustard was in full bloom. These tiny yellow flowers, ankle-high on a bare foot, grow only in Middle Tennessee. As soon as I saw them, I pulled over and parked. Taking care not to bother the young couple having a picnic among the flowers, I knelt and bent close. On a still day, their faint scent is a sweetness unlike anything else. Nashville mustard, a remnant from the days when Shortgrass Prairie was this area's primary ecosystem, when the buffalo made their ancient traces through it, is in the midst of a glorious superbloom. Today it grows mainly on public land that is managed by metro parks to keep the flowers safe. If they are bulldozed by development, poisoned by lawn chemicals, or mowed before the seeds have time to set, these vestiges of a bygone era will be lost forever. Reading the work of the Nashville naturalist Joanna Brichetto, author of This Is How a Robin Drinks, Essays on Urban Nature, taught me everything I know about Nashville mustard and about how our town has worked to keep it safe. As she writes in a recent blog post, we are also lucky that Metro Parks does not apply herbicides to their lawns. Park lawns must be tidy, but the older ones are a tidy mosaic of different grasses, sedges, wildflowers, native and not. This is a good model for homeowners, that lawns can be lawns without herbicides. Encouraged by the wildflower show at Elmington Park, I set off last week to see as many patches of Nashville mustard as I could find. At a time when losses in the natural world are in hyperdrive for no reason but the short-sighted stupidity of the people who now make this country's environmental policy, a flower that survives humanity by virtue of the stewardship of others can be a kind of guiding spirit. The way those yellow flowers lifted my heart may also explain why I set my alarm, despite the cloud cover, to wake in time to see the bloodworm moon. That's the thing about cloud cover. You never know when a break in the clouds will allow a glimpse of something amazing, something that predates us and is yet unruined by human hands. In very dark times, just the barest chance to witness something beautiful is enough to give a person hope. When the alarm went off at 1:30 a.m., my husband got up to dress, but I threw on my bathrobe and went straight outside. And there it was, above the bare trees and the streetlights, above the silent street itself and all the sleeping houses draped in the many nightlights of suburban fear, there it was, the sky was clear, and the moon was tucked high among the clear stars just as it always is whether we can see it or not. But it wasn't blood red at all. Above our house at least it was some other color of red. Something like rust and something like the dust of iron ore in a steel mill town. In truth, it was like no other color of red I know. It was the color of something that doesn't belong to this world. I stood and looked, marveling in the dark at a wonder that had nothing to do with me, or with any of us. In the sky, it unfolded in its ancient way, untouched by the storms gathering on a wounded planet. A helicopter flew across the sky while I stood there, and then came an airplane on a higher path just behind it. But of course they couldn't touch the red of that moon, or the moon itself, and there was comfort in that. A little comfort, anyway. Margaret Renkel, a contributing opinion writer, is the author of the books The Comfort of Crows, A Backyard Year, Graceland at Last, and Late Migrations.
And that piece taken from a recent column by Margaret Renkel in the New York Times. You are listening to Green Zine. We're down to the train is running a little bit late today. If you're trying to catch it, it will not be in White River Junction for about another 15 minutes or so. Well, are you thinking about an EV? Well, they're going to be harder to get. This is from Green Car Reports. I get this on a daily basis. President Trump is planning to kill the EV tax credits, and this story says that this would decimate U.S. industries. Produced by the Repeat Project, a Princeton University group that analyzes environmental policy. The study found that killing the $7,500 tax credit would reduce EV demand as well as endanger manufacturing jobs. A lot of jobs are sort of endangered these days, associated with making those vehicles and the batteries that power them. The report is also the only analysis I'm aware of to date that draws the connection to U.S. manufacturing as well, Jesse Jenkins, an assistant professor at Princeton, said, and the study's project leader, told a outfit called Electrek in an emailed statement. Without the tax credit, researchers estimate that EV sales in the U.S. could decrease 30%. They've been on an upswing, but they could start to go down 30% by 2027 and nearly 40% by 2030. I still think there are going to be other cars to replace them. That might cut predicted EV market share from 18% to 13% next year and from 40% to 24% in 2030. According to the study, such a shutdown could lead to 100% of planned expansions of U.S. EV assembly plants being canceled and could make 29% to 72% of U.S. battery manufacturing capacity redundant, according to the study. Factories that are idle or never built in the first place mean fewer jobs, and based on the distribution of current EV-related manufacturing projects, red states could be hit the hardest. Yeah. All right. I'm looking at the time. We still have plenty of time here, and I am going to be going to Sustainable Woodstock. Let me go to one more paragraph in this story. Analysts have viewed the tax credit as vital to continuing U.S. EV sales growth. It was among the trends that led Standard & Poor Global Mobility in 2023 to predict that U.S. EV sales could more than double by 2030. Well, turn those numbers on their head. But the Trump administration is expected to target the credit. It hasn't happened yet, I don't think, just as it's targeted other Biden administration policies related to charging infrastructure and emission standards. Actually, some of that has happened already. Let's start a little bit of music here. We like good music. This is featuring the great Australian guitarist Tommy Emmanuel, joined by some pretty other solid players, as in David Grisman and... I want to get this right. Oh, yeah, Brian Sutton on guitar, and, of course, David Grisman, the dog, on the mandolin. Well, before I get to our last story of the day, and there's plenty more, Henry will be back next week, and then he'll be posting things up on our website. Just go to WFVR.org and look for Green Zine, and you get some more links and information to what's happening. Green Zine is brought to you today by Soliflect, also by Bale, Royal Trailworks, Daniel Leibowitz, the Upper Paz Beer Company, First Branch Coffee Company, Solarfest, Wit and Grit, and the Yes We Can Collective. Are you into seeing a movie for free? Well, you should check out Sustainable Woodstock. Here's the website, sustainablewoodstock.org. They've got a fine mission statement, and it's pretty short. We exist to lead our communities through the climate emergency, empowering Woodstock and the rest of the Upper Valley to meet climate commitments and live sustainably through advocacy, education, and collaboration. Green Drinks is happening tonight. It is about farm and wilderness conservation. Get information on that by going to that website. And a film, let's click on this so we can give you specific dates. It's called Single Use Planet. The film is, it's narrated by Peter Coyote, features entertaining animation and musical interludes that help illustrate the connections between public health, plastics production, and industry influence on government policy. I have a feeling that Carol Langstaff might be interested in this movie. It will be available to the general public by going to the website between March 26th, so that's about a week away. It's only going to run for 3 days, March 26th, 27th, and 28th. And you can see a trailer for it at the website sustainablewoodstock.org. Well, we're winding down, and it is a Thursday. If you're catching the show in live time, Rebecca Began expected to come into the studio this afternoon. She was going to be taking some time off due to the mud, but it sounds like she's going to be able to make it for In My Bones, all African music from 1 to 2 p.m. this afternoon after Democracy Now! And then we've got Tom Healy in with Concert Music Safari, classical music, occasionally some opera. That will be from 2 to 4, as I said. And then my so-called radio show with Morgan Haynes from 4 to 5 p.m. Hannah Handy and me with, yep, Johnny Two Scoops Duffy. from 5 to 7. At 7, Mort Wasserman in with Fourth Branch Jazz. And at 9 o'clock, we wrap up our full day of music programming. Don't worry, there's stuff after 11 if you're up, but the Wood Warblers Jazzgrass Radio Show is on from 9 to 11 with a rebroadcast on Saturdays at 10 a.m. Hey, thanks for joining me on Green Zine. We look forward to Henry Swayze rejoining me in the studio next week. And thanks to everyone for supporting us at our recent fund drive. We did really well. We had almost 100 different folks contribute to the radio station. We're in good fiscal shape thanks to our members and underwriters, and we really appreciate that.